The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Ireland's savings specialists. Rabodirect, the straight-talking savings bank.
Thank you very much indeed. Now, we have just been joined by Declan Power, a security analyst, and he's just back from South Sudan. But actually, Declan, you, because we were talking about Korea earlier on, and we were to get a call to North Korea now from an Irish chap that's over there, but no calls going in or coming out now at the moment.
Surprise.
No surprise.
No, no. In fact, it's not that long ago I remember talking to somebody. I'm not sure. I think it was on this show. You had a guest on who had been one of the few people who went in there and he made a documentary.
That's right.
Yeah. Do you remember he was talking about the size of their heads? Because of the poor diet, that when you went out into the countryside, people were not emaciated, but on the verge of it. Like, they were living a kind of like an austere lifestyle. And when you compared it, you know, as he did, with how people looked in South Korea.
Yeah.
And then, of course, their mindsets and how they looked at the world.
Yeah.
The little bit they get to see.
Yeah.
It's a whole other story.
Right, yeah. Well, I mean, I wonder if there is... I don't know if this is a patronising beyond imagination thing to say. I wonder if there is the capability to do what they did to Sony's there. As you were saying, it's usually a fella in a...
Yeah, I think that was Colin was saying, yes,
it
is normally a fella in his dressing gown in his mother's house. Yeah, he doesn't go out much who's doing it.
Yeah, mind you, they have them, I presume, in North Korea as well.
I would imagine. I would say when it comes to any matters of espionage, the North Koreans wouldn't be behind the door and spending money. Having said that, though, you know, you would also wonder to what end strategically. Certainly, I'm a bit cynical, but I can't help thinking, isn't this massive publicity for Sony? You know, if you wait another 2 months and then release it.
But why is Obama getting involved? This is what I find very bizarre. Why is he getting involved in this case when there's so many more things you could be talking about with North Korea?
You're right. You're right, Cathy. But I'd say the same thing. It's the same reason he got involved. I was in Africa at the time in 2012 in the Joseph Kony, the Lord's Resistance.
Yes.
The power of public
social
opinion
media,
and social media, it shows its potency when the president of the US has to swing off, veer off track to deal with this stuff, to keep the great, shall we say, unwashed happy. And that's a variation of the theme here.
Why do you think, David?
I think there's two words, nuclear weapons, in terms of North Korea.
Right. Yeah.
And in terms of, you know, here you have one of the worst regimes on the planet. You have one of the most unstable, you know, well, it's a stable regime, but it has the potential to cause a lot of trouble in the region. The Japanese are unsettled. The South Koreans are unsettled. The Chinese, who are the North Koreans' biggest, you know, sort of backers, they're unsettled by the thought of instability in North Korea.
Yeah.
So, the fact that the North Koreans are up to all sorts of mischief, you know, in the sense of they've been, you know, involved in sort of, they've been helping the Iranians, they've been helping the Syrians, they've been procuring their own nuclear weapons, they've been, you know, basically sort of stirring regional tensions. And, you know, regional tensions in that area are, you know, there's so much sort of going on. The Chinese basically, you know, I suspect the Chinese, you know, don't much care for the North Koreans, they don't much care for Kim Jong-un, but they do not want, you know, A, the North Korea to implode and, you know, what all the regional strategic implications that has. So I think there's, you know, the US wants to sort of, you know, Obama's basically stepping in and saying, here's, you know, people are scared of North Korea, you know.
Yeah.
You want to sort of compare North Korea and Cuba, you know, we can talk about Cuba later, but...
Yes, we will.
I mean, nobody's scared of Cuba, but, everyone's worried in, you know, about the North Koreans, what they might do next. You know, there's a lot of irrationality.
But wouldn't that be a good time maybe then to keep your trap shut?
I mean, you know... Sorry, excuse me. I think there's, you know...
It's the best piece of publicity for Sony. You couldn't...
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing is that, you know, Sony, Pictures, headquarters in Japan, they are concerned, you know, in the sense of, you've got a picture coming out of America that shows the, you know, I haven't seen the film, but, from what I've read, it shows at one stage, one of the edits had the head of Kim Jong-un exploding rather violently. And, you know, perceptions, given the tensions, the long, you know, standing tensions in the region between Japan and North Korea, you know, what is that regional impact? So the head of Japanese head of Sony is saying, lads, tone it down a little bit. So he's concerned, you know, about the sort of the issue in his backyard or in his neighbourhood.
Excellent point. Or his staff.
You remember the censorship effectively that was imposed when people had cartoons about
The Prophet.
The Prophet, Muhammad. Yeah. Yeah. And that was pretty far-reaching.
Yeah.
People feared for their lives, people who worked for these newspapers and so on. Yeah. The other thing, Marion, just on capability, clearly if they have nuclear capability, they can hack.
I withdraw that stupid question with great apologies.
Yeah.
Now, you are also back from where we're going to tip around, because there's a lot going on in the world at the moment. Like you were just talking about the uncertainty and imbalance and all of those things. You're just back from Jordan and Syrian border.
Yeah, Syrian border. I went there with UNICEF and we went to the Al-Zaatari refugee camp, which is now, I think, the fourth or fifth biggest city, in inverted commas, in Jordan. And the people who've left Syria over the last couple of years, they've gone all over the place. They've gone to Iraq. I mean, imagine things are so bad, you go to Iraq to get away. But the Jordanian camp is one of the biggest, and there's roughly 84,000 people in it. 40,000 of those are children. And it's like a lunar landscape with little tents. And I don't know if you've seen it, but it's got tents. Mm-hmm. And it's got, if you're really lucky, you have a prefab. And there are something like 10 babies being born every day. And you have this idea in your head about this part of the world being warm. It's not warm. It's coming up to the point where we're going to have a foot and a half of snow. These people are already freezing and they are going to be bitterly cold. We met this very young couple, and they had a 5-week-old baby, and they're in a tent in the middle of nowhere. I mean, they're getting, some food stamps from the World Food Programme, which is in doubt now because the World Food Programme is in trouble in this area. Their little baby has had vaccinations, but the mother is afraid to already bring the baby outside the tent because he'll die of the cold. And what are they going to do in 2 weeks when they're living in a foot and a half of snow? So what UNICEF does out there in conjunction with everyone else, UNHCR, we're involved in a winterization program at this moment to try and give 40,000 vulnerable people vouchers to get some winter clothes. Unfortunately, the reality is that some of them outside the camps, you can get outside Al-Zaatari. You can't work when you're in Al-Zaatari. But if you can get a sort of a host family in Amman, the capital city, you might get outside and you're living in a pretty appalling condition, unfortunately. But you can get out, you're no longer in the camp, you can work, you can do something. And we met one woman who's there with her 5 children, obviously all deeply traumatized by, they came from Damascus, by what happened to them there in Damascus. And she had been given, I'm just trying to think of exactly how much money it is, but they get in vouchers to spend to buy winter clothes for the kids. But she was she had a Supersur. I mean, and that is a thing of great joy in Al-Zaatari or outside. A Supersur is a fabulous thing. I mean, God be with the days when...
We all had one of those.
I know, but it's just a different world. And they have nothing. Like, these people, they left with nothing. There's a couple of little streets in the camp, and they're sort of amusingly called the Champs-Élysées, because it was a French hospital there for a while, so they stuck up the sign. And, there are things you can buy, but most of the people don't have the money for it, because they get 120 Jordanian dollars, which is about, 130 euros a month per family to live on, and a loaf of bread costs 3 Jordanian dollars.
Though the Jordanians have been very generous, have they not?
They have been absolutely amazing.
In the whole question of refugees, I mean, it's changing the balance of population within their own country.
Well, I mean, look at Lebanon, where I think something like 20% of the people in Lebanon, am I right, are now refugees. And certainly the Jordanian camps would be among the best of the camps. They have another camp nearby, which is a purpose-built camp, because Al-Zaatari was sort of set up very, very quickly. And the earlier parts of it, it's divided into 12 districts in a sort of a very frightening Hunger Games way. But the first couple of districts are very much thrown together. But then thereafter, it's very well laid out. They've got 3 UNICEF-run schools. They've got psychosocial counselling, which is very, very important for the kids who've seen such dreadful things. But they have another camp now, which has about 13,000 people in it. But the number of refugees, the trickle, is almost stopped now because they can't get through. I mean, the people we talked to, they discussed their whole trip through Syria and this bizarre series of, buses they'd get on and they're leaving in the middle of the night and their homes have been bombed and leaving with nothing but like their kids in their arms and the clothes on their backs.
Yeah,
and I do think we're living at a time of charity fatigue. I mean, I really do, because there's so much, we've so much going on in our own country. We're talking about, we'll say, mental health. We're talking about people sleeping on the streets. We're looking at poverty in general. You know,
I think that whatever about poverty fatigue, I think since the crash here, overseas donations,
of course,
have people's attitude to that has changed, and they would prefer to give locally.
And I think that's absolutely an excellent point. But I think we can't not look at the rest of the world. You know, we cannot. There's some wonderful Clinton quote which I now can't remember, but we can't strive to have the best lives and leave other people to have appalling lives. The thing is, since 2008, the number of children living in poverty has risen. So I think it was about 74 million children around the world living now. It's about 76 million children. And that extra 2 million children are in the westernised, rich nations. So certainly in our own country, we have seen children who are now living in poverty. And we must do everything we can for them. But I think we need to spread our charity.
If you take the Syrian thing, and I really do think that the Jordanians have been particularly good. Do you know the level of refugees between all of the destinations that they chose?
I wouldn't have the figure, but just when you mentioned the Jordanians, I had a colleague who was working there for a period a year or two ago. And the thing about the Jordanians were they were very proactive, partially out of altruism and partially out of the recognition of the huge instability that a mass of refugees coming in can cause. And so having the camps in place and having a system in place in terms of remuneration and welfare contributed hugely. Now, as Cathy said, there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing across the border, and that has largely ceased. There was a big operation taking place in terms of an expectation of a move into Syria, that there would be some sort of a ceasefire, and the humanitarian community and UN agencies were going to move in en masse, and there was going to be huge military support to create corridors and zones of safety.
Right,
none of that happened, and Jordan was going to be the base for it.
Yeah.
And the idea was that these people would be able to funnel back in. Now that hasn't happened, and the Jordanians are still having to pony up with the money. They're a wealthy state, but I mean, should never underestimate the potential for instability that can be caused by having this mass of people. A smaller example would be something that I've seen in terms of South Sudan, where you have what are called protection of civilian sites, POCs, that are really basically small IDP, small
internally displaced.
Who are refugees within their own country, for want of a better way. Legally, they're called ITVs because they haven't crossed a border. But they fled to areas around the UN camps because they wanted safety when the attempted coup took place last year. And surprisingly, you know, one of the big threats to stability at the moment in South Sudan isn't the probably forthcoming dry season offensive when, you know, conventional conflict may resume. It's the level of crime. It's the level of instability. Those sites, if they're not properly managed.
Yeah.
Now, the Jordanians have managed theirs, but there's a whole level of criminality, assault, various things happening within the camps. And then they spill out of the camps.
Yeah.
They spill out of the camps into other areas, and ordinary civilians are robbed or assaulted. International community members are assaulted or their vehicles robbed. In one case, I was talking to an officer I work closely with, a British officer, who talked about people spilling into the UN sites and the UN forces having to take stringent measures, but they couldn't. In one case, it was serious enough that they might have had to open fire. And he said, we can't do that under any circumstances because they're protection of civilian sites.
Yes.
And everybody gets this kind of touchy-feely notion. But when you've got a large bunch of people who've been disenfranchised, who've been moved in fear of their life, they've tucked to their heels to get away from conflict. Now they're in an area where they're living with maybe a sheet of UNICEF plastic over a bit of wood, and they're getting handed the bare minimum to survive. And they get pretty browned off every now and again. And you're talking about people for the most part that are in their 20s and 30s. They're the younger and fitter. And every now and again that bubbles over. And they're not touchy and feely when they get browned off. And trying to cope with that and deal with that, well, you know, you need a bit of Solomon-like wisdom, and you need to be able to apply it pretty damn quickly.
Right.
That's an excellent point. Actually, to go back to that, 5.2 million people are outside Syria
That have fled
Syria. Yeah, all
it's
around.
A staggering number.
It
of
is.
People.
Well, it's the biggest refugee crisis since World War II. And I mean, that is an excellent point. I mean, in the camps, they are, you know, there's so many things. They're trying to do things with the young men who are the young men who, as we all know, are the dangerous young men who are disenfranchised and have nothing
hope,
to
no
do.
No hope.
Yeah, and you know, trying to get them back into some sort of informal schooling so they can catch up. But yes, of course, it's a huge.
You come back to what we were talking about a while ago too, in terms of Obama and instability and the region and the Japanese mind. If you take what has happened now with ISIS and you've got them on the borders with Turkey and you've got your people going into Iraq and you've got your refugees there, and you have everybody, not everybody, but you have a very significant number of people who are so alienated that they've started this ISIS, who are terrifying people. And it may mean that Barack Obama will have to end up in company with Assad. I mean, it is amazing how what goes round and the kind of consequences from each step along the way, because presumably Assad is the only one that can create stability
to a point. Sorry, Cathy, go on.
No, I was going to say that, you know, when you talk to the people, they're all terrified of being identified because they are all coming out and saying, it's the regime, it's the regime. I mean, we look at that as one of the most bloodthirsty regimes. Mm. You know, families have been disappearing for years. So they don't want to go back until the regime is gone. And there were plenty of women we talked to whose husbands were gone. They said, oh, well, my husband is back in Syria. We knew that meant that he was fighting.
Yeah. But, you know, in connection with that, and it ties in with what you were saying there, Marion, is that the regime are in their midst. When you've got great swaths of refugees moving around or they're near an area, you can be sure that they will be riddled with various agents and informers. And the governments in these situations, this is, again, one of the advantages. If you're going to be a refugee, being in Jordan is probably one of the better places, because at least the Jordanian government don't have any axe to grind. In other areas, they will have, and you can have a mixture of agent provocateurs in a large IDP camp who will cause incidents to cause an overreaction, or maybe the government that's in charge of the area where the IDP camp is wants to affect a reaction. And there are all kinds of little games being played, and the people who are the cannon fodder in these games are the ordinary IDPs. And one example comes to mind is that where inadvertently other organisations or well-meaning people get drawn in. I can remember an incident in a camp in Darfur that was called Kalma. You reminded me of it when you were talking about Saturday camp. And there was a huge mass of people there and they lived very frugally. And the regime at the time were trying to claim that they were harbouring a lot of weapons and rebel fighters. And there may well have been. Very hard to police these camps. But they started to claim that they had seized weapons and they brought some various international community members in to see this. Now, there was no provenance of the information. The weapons were displayed in a police headquarters and there was only a few rocket launchers and a few rusty AK-47s. I saw them myself. And then somebody within a particular organisation, an international organisation, wrote a report that was circulated about heavy artillery weapons and shells. Now, this lady meant well. She was taking the vernacular and terminology that a regime senior officer used. I was looking at this and I said, at a meeting, I remember making the point, to call this heavy artillery is like calling a mini metro an articulated truck. And, but the problem was this would get circulated into the media, into international media. And then if there was a shot fired, the regime could say, well, we had to send in the troops because the place is full of heavy artillery. Right. And they were manufacturing their pretext and reason. And some weeks later, they did go in and there were a number of fatalities. And so the simplicity of when we hear about these things, there was a reaction, the machinations are going on internally beforehand.
Okay. I know that you want to get in there, David, but I have to take a break. We'll be back with you straight after this.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.